The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, and this is what our forebears were commended for. The text, if you look it up in the New Testament, is a list of forebears who, in the Hebrew Bible, lived by faith. When I personally think of exemplars of the existential faith that influences and still sustains my own life, I think of my maternal grandparents who came to this country as orphans, having lost their parents as teenagers. Came separately as immigrants from Slovakia, met and married in Chicago around 1910, and soon had four children. But by the end of the last great pandemic, the influenza pandemic of 1919, they had buried all four of those children. My grandmother herself nearly died. Their Catholic priest declined to come to the home to give her the last rites, and I have some sympathy for him, fearing infection. But my grandfather then gave up on church and any conventional faith. And yet I would not be here if they had not kept going by faith and had three more children by 1925. Once I asked my grandmother why she kept going to church. Oh, Yanni, she said, I go there, I see people who have sorrows like mine or greater. I pray with them and for them and for your grandpa that it is no good to be bitter or give up on life. That's why I keep going. Her saying so reminded me of another time of crisis that they had to go through as a family that my mother could hardly speak about. During the Great Depression, my grandfather lost his job as an auto worker. Some slick sales guy had sold him a plot of land in South Texas where he was told he'd be able to pick the grapefruit off the trees. He rented out the house for a little income, moved the family there, and according to my mother, who refused to say more, they nearly starved. After a year or so, they had to come home, and Grandpa took the only work he could find, kind of like Joseph Coolidge at the Quaddy House, keeping a tavern. Girls in immigrant families in those days didn't go to college much. But when my mom graduated at the near top of her class in a big urban high school, her father, who had only 3 years of schooling himself, came up to her and said, "You smart girl, you go college. I find a way to pay." Today, I think of stories in the life of this religious center with a civic circumference, as I called it in my history of the congregation, my history of Unitarian Universalists in the city since 1850. And I ask, wasn't it by faith that those 24 guys stayed after worship on the 20th of October in 1850 and formed a formal First Unitarian Society? Sometimes faith shows up in different forms. Simple persistence. For the first 3 years, fires burned down San Francisco roughly every few months. The rented halls where the congregation began all disappeared. And yet, in 1853, They built a so-called fireproof building, brick and stucco, down on Stockton Street, now in Chinatown, that would seat 1,000 people, and invited the Reverend Joseph Harrington to come with his family to be their pastor. He preached 3 Sundays for them before he died of yellow fever. The trustees gave his entire year's salary, 2.5 times what a minister would make in Boston because it was so expensive out here, to his widow and child, and then raised more funds for her and for her passage back east. Then they advertised themselves to people in Boston as offering the largest and wealthiest congregation in the city to attract a new minister. It was true. Some of the greatest merchants and lawyers in San Francisco had formed this congregation. And boy, they were needed, because in 1856, when the local economy collapsed because the gold rush was over and the church went into debt, well, they persisted. Even when a Unitarian trustee and journalist was shot and killed on the street for printing the truth about another newspaper editor, that he had bribed the sheriff to put him on the city council, and that he had formerly been a resident at a place called Sing Sing. The Unitarian merchants and lawyers rose up and formed the Second Vigilance Committee in the city, cleaning out City Hall, combining city and county government with one of their own as mayor. David Chu told this story from this pulpit 11 years ago on my first Sunday as your senior minister. The minister in that tumult was a scholarly, quiet man named Rufus Cutler, who served well enough until at an annual meeting, one of the men made a motion to appoint him as a committee of one to find a minister's wife. Disinclined to marriage, Rufus took the hint and went back east to teach Latin. Thomas Starr King, our real star in the past firmament, turned down better offers from Eastern congregations to come out here in 1860. One church in Cincinnati said that he could have a whole year off to go to Europe with his family if he would just settle along the Ohio River. Because sometimes faith does look a little bit like sacrifice. His wife, Julia, hated it here initially. She called it San Francisco, because the dunes kept blowing in under the windows and doors and making her housekeeping near impossible. Starr King himself gave speeches in favor of the Union cause in front of pro-slavery miners who were armed with Bowie knives and pistols. He fought chronic TB, wore himself down, raising more money for humanitarian relief than anyone to that point in American history. And black Americans who had fled racist California for Canada sent him $1,000 for the Union cause, and he took Julia with him all the way to Victoria on Vancouver Island, just to thank them. When the Stockton Street Church, with its room for 1,000, proved too small for the crowds that he attracted, the trustees built that gaudy neo-Gothic structure on Union Square that seated 1,600 and that almost embarrassed him. He preached there 7 times before he died of diphtheria, his last wish being that the congregation retire the church debt. By faith, the congregation trusted Henry Whitney Bellows, who came out from New York to console them when he recommended that they call Horatio Stebbins, of whom I'll say more tomorrow night. Pretty good choice. He lasted 36 years. Let me just say that he'd been a poor New England farm boy who struggled to get an education, once walking from Western Massachusetts to Ithaca, New York, to improve his Latin. Out here, he turned a small men's school called the College of California, then in Oakland, into the university in Berkeley, of which he served as a regent for 26 years. And then he advised the Stanford family when they wanted to memorialize their son with another university and served as a trustee there as well. Oh yeah, and he did really intervene with Mark Twain when he was in what Twain himself called his slinking period, drinking and unable to pay his bills at the boarding house. Stebbins' pastoral touch was legendary in the city. And during his long tenure, the church acquired the Society for Christian, later Community Work, and the Hinckley Fund to help others beyond the walls of the congregation. And he had the courage to stand up and denounce to their face two successive governors for giving in to anti-Chinese, anti-Asian bias. Because sometimes faith looks like sticking to your ideals and saying so. It was Stebbins who helped the congregation make the tough decision to move from Union Square, from a building that had been damaged by an earthquake, and that cable car inventor Andrew Smith Hallady had said might fall down before they sold it, and move here. And in this building, when the earthquake and fire of 2006 caused the bell to fall through the ceiling, his successor, Bradford Levitt, led the interfaith relief efforts across the city and stood at the gate of the Presidio doing triage. Able-bodied men camping over here, women and children, and those injured to the ferries and across the bay. When he saw that the rapid rebuilding of the city included skimming at once again corrupt City Hall, Levitt went after the mayor and the supervisors, who all belonged to the ill-named Working Men's Party, which had started as the anti-Chinese party and was now involved in shaking down employers with promises of no labor troubles if they would just provide their lawyer with retainers, otherwise known as bribes. Lots of business leaders liked what they called the system. And when the mayor went on trial at Temple Sherith Israel, which had been pressed into service as the temporary courtroom, somebody went in and shot the prosecutor in the back of the head. Right here in our city. Levitt organized the clergy across all faith lines to insist that the corruption had to end. Because often the best faith action then and now is interfaith action. And I would venture to say that no congregation in this city has known that better through history than this one. And then there are times when faith looks most like loyalty. There have been plenty of times that have challenged members of this congregation. During the Great Depression and World War II, Caleb Dutton, who served another 36 years as minister, as long as Stebbins, stayed on longer than he wanted to as well, partly because clergy weren't covered by Social Security initially. And church finances and membership in the Depression and World War II sank to such a low that by 1949, there were only 120 members here and 20 or 30 people on a Sunday morning. You know, sometimes the ups and downs of life are as steep as the hills of this city. Harry Meserve, whose prayer we heard last Sunday from Diane Miller, came to revive the church. And it grew like many religious communities during the 1950s, even as redevelopment was changing the neighborhood and pressuring the trustees to buy the adjacent land and build quickly on it. By the 1960s, when the Aligned Sisters left the church a huge legacy of some $1.8 million, the equivalent of about $30 million today, the membership was well over 1,000. There were more than 300 children in the church school. And though both Harry Schofield, the minister, and Howard Mattson, who went on to do the ministry with the farm workers, recommended against building the center, instead building something like high-rise housing for low-income seniors. In 1967, the building of the center, expected to cost only about $1 million, by the time the repairs to the church were included, cost $2.5 million, with $500,000 borrowed. And the changes of the time, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the disillusionment of many idealists, well, the congregation lost 400 members. And people thought this was a rich church. What with the Hinckley Fund and the SCW doing good works in the wider city. And so congregational giving was meh. While the staff required by the center to this day is costly. The demands on the ministry here, as Diane Miller put it last Sunday, were greater than the money supply. And there ensued a period of what I can only call some internal finger pointing and distrust, loss of faith, between congregation trustees and ministers. Some of you lived through that. It was greatly stabilized during the ministry of my dear friend Margot Campbell Gross and her partner in ministry, John Marsh, when a capital campaign made the building more accessible and more seismically sound, and when new and proud outreach efforts began through the Faithful Fools and the Tenderloin and the after-school program called Up on Top for low-income children. But I still had to, during my time as senior minister, expose that we were underfunded and needed more loyalty and faith. One reason I wrote the history, a religious center with a civic circumference, was to show just how wide our outreach and our mission has gone, and how often it's been noble and affected, but has sometimes exceeded our realistic limitations as a congregation. And now in this new time of crisis in our whole country, when our dearest values of democracy and inclusivity, human dignity and human rights are under unprecedented attack by our own national leaders, and so many of us are in grief and in shock and in even despair, all I can say is that it worries me how often I hear what one of my colleagues calls the hidden despair, the secret despair of the secular left, even in our own midst. Certainly among some climate change activists who project just gloom and doom for the future. I sense it in young people convinced that there's not going to be any social safety net, no social security when I get old. And what this tells me is simple. The mission of this church is more important than ever. We need to redouble our own spiritual practices of daily renewing gratitude and faith, in appreciating the unmerited beauty that is being itself every moment that we are still alive. We need to show progressives a way to be authentically religious in the way that our call to worship summoned us to. We need to address those who say that they are spiritual but not religious, that there is a way to be in community without parking your brain at the door or your individual experiences feel slighted or your previous affiliations neglected. We need to show the value of community that embraces diversity and that teaches the art of authentic respect for difference and the rebuilding of faith and trust in human connection and mutual care. We need to do this not because we are the only place that can do it, but because as our partnership with our neighbors shows, we can rebuild the neighborhood and perhaps the nation. We have come thus far by faith, my friends. Though the forms may have changed, may the inner faith held and deepened here in our midst neither fail nor ever falter. I ask this in the names of all those, known and unknown, present and absent, remembered and forgotten, who have been and even are now exemplars of a true and humanly liberating faith. So may it be. Amen. For most of the history of this congregation, at least until a visit in the 1920s by the son of the Baha'i prophet Baha'u'llah, no sermon was preached from this pulpit without a scriptural text. And so today I choose a single verse from the Epistle to the Hebrews. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. This is what our forebears were commended for. To which I add this modern commentary on faith by the late Frederick Buechner. Faith is better understood as a verb than as a noun, as a process rather than a possession. It is in the best of us an on-again, off-again, rather than once and for all thing. Faith is not being sure where you're going, but going anyway. A journey without maps. Paul Tillich said that doubt isn't the opposite of faith, it is an essential element of faith. I have faith because my friend is my friend. It is possible that all his motives are ulterior, but there's something about the way I feel when he's around, about the way he looks me in the eye, the way we can talk to each other without pretense and be silent together without embarrassment, that makes me willing to put my life in his hands as I do each time I call him friend. I can't prove the friendship of my friend. When I experience it, I don't need to. When I don't experience it, no proof will do. If I tried to put his friendship to the test somehow, the test would ruin the friendship that I was testing. And so it is with the faith I try to restore each day at its dawning. Faith can't prove a damn thing, you know, or a blessed thing either. There ends our reading. I would be remiss on an occasion like this if I didn't call your attention to the presence in our midst of a particularly notable figure from the distinguished history of our congregation. Your Imperial Majesty, may I invite you forward for a moment? The Emperor Norton is with us. Uh, It's my understanding, Your Majesty, that you, like many people in the 1850s, came here as an immigrant yourself. Is that correct?
Indeed, yes, I did. I was born just outside of London, in Deptford, on February 4th, 1818. Moved to South Africa when I was about 2 years old and came to San Francisco in 1849.
Ah, and I understand that it was the troubles of American politics in the 1850s that inspired your proclamation of the empire. Is
that correct? Oh, yes, yes, definitely, because I felt this country was going in the wrong direction, especially in regards to slavery, and that if we had an emperor, things would run much more smoothly.
Well, after the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shot and killed the United States Senator on Ocean Beach, I can see how you came to that opinion.
Indeed, that was a terrible time, wasn't it?
It was indeed. It was just before our distinguished minister, Thomas Starr King, came from the East. And I understand you attended our services during that period.
Indeed, I did. Yes, yes. I loved hearing Thomas Starr King give his weekly sermon. And of course, I attended here. I attended numerous churches as well as synagogues.
But wasn't it the case that you told Charles Murdoch, who printed some of your script and proclamations, that when you came into your power, it would be your desire that there be only one church?
Yes, because I felt that much of the strife in this world, much of the disagreement, came from religious disagreements. That if we had a universal religion, that would be nullified.
And we offer ourselves to that service, as we did then. Thomas Starr King was extremely inclusive in his approach to religion, you know. He regularly exchanged pulpits with the rabbi at Temple Emmanuel the like. And I understand at one point you came to Charles Murdoch, your special friend in this congregation, and suggested that you had need of an empress, and perhaps he could find among the Unitarian ladies someone who would step forward for that role.
Yes, well, that didn't quite work out the way we had planned. There was a woman that we were considering as a consort, a Minnie Wakeman, but she was betrothed to another.
Ah, so it goes.
Never looked until the 1950s when, of course, the widow Norton came into prominence, Jose Saria.
Ah, I see. Oh, well. And you also would have been familiar with Horatio Stebbins then, who was the minister who followed Thomas Starr King.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. I would come to hear him quite often, and he wrote some very nice things about me.
Yes, he did indeed. He had a special knack for going down the street and stopping with anyone that he saw, even if the person was, say, inebriated, and inquiring about them, and he had a relationship even with Mark Twain.
Oh, yes, I heard about that, indeed. Well, I met Twain on a number of occasions, or Clemens, as I prefer to refer to
him.
Yes,
well.
And he wrote about me on a number of occasions, unfortunately, not some very nice things.
Well, he had a tendency to turn on his friends.
Indeed, indeed.
Even Bret Hart, who brought him to this church, who arguably made him a famous literary figure, Twain was not very kind to later in his life.
No, indeed. And I think we would refer to him today as a curmudgeon.
Yes, well, the best of us at times lose faith and become a bit cynical.
Yes.
But here we try to revive the best in each human being. And it is your ministry on the streets of this city that continues to bring joy to people and to remind them that the world we dream of, people united, perhaps in an empire, perhaps a greater republic, is indeed the world we should be working for.
Indeed, and may we all have peace and harmony.
Thank you for joining us this morning, Your Imperial Highness.
It is a privilege and an honor. Thank you.